You are listening to.
Listening to.
You are listening to.
Black is.
Black is.
Black is.
Black is.
Black is.
BlackIsOnline.com.
Right.
What's going on, y'all? Thank you for tuning in to another episode of The Break, brought to you by the Black Is Network. My name is Chris, one half of the brothers, Layman. So we got a good conversation coming for y'all. Casey and I, you know, with everything that's going on, we had a longtime friend who's been LAPD, who's a cop. You know, we have been talking to him, you know, for a while about trying to get him on, and we didn't want to get a chance to talk to him, ask some questions and whatnot. So we finally got the chance to sit down with him, had some of the crew come through. Some of the crew didn't feel like coming through, didn't feel like they could sit with him. It's understandable, but it was a good conversation. So in this part of the conversation, some of the things we touch on are lack of cultural awareness. We asked him what he thinks his role of a police officer should be, policing our own communities, the shootings of Alton Sterling and Philando Castillo. We asked him his thoughts on that. It's very interesting. You know, this is only part one of the conversation. Let us know what you guys think. Please chime in. Email kc@blackisonline.com, voicemail 323-455-4219, Twitter Black Is Online, Facebook Black Is Magazine. You can always get at us on our website, blackisonline.com.
About everything that's going on. I saw the other thing that you posted about people just not posting ignorant stuff about Black Lives Matter and all of that.
I fight a war on two fronts.
Okay.
And so I see both sides. What I see is a lot of misunderstanding.
Okay.
I see a lot of people who don't understand what the other side thinks they're saying. And I see a lot of people who don't understand what the other side is saying.
On both sides.
On both sides.
Okay.
And I find myself having discussions with both.
Okay.
You know, I don't know how many people you know personally that you talk to on a regular basis that you would say is a Trump supporter.
Okay.
Like people you hang out with and eat lunch with.
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
I have that.
Okay.
I eat lunch with Trump supporters.
Okay. Okay.
So, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, they surround themselves with people very much like themselves. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, kind of muster in their outrage. They kind of feed off of each other, and they get upset, and they lash out and say, you know, this is what, you know, our community or the people like us think. Mm-hmm. Never really having any input from the other side.
Okay.
And so my big thing is that I think, and this is probably true of every issue, every controversial issue in the country, mm-hmm. is that people need to spend less time with people who agree with them.
Agreed.
And they need to spend more time with people who don't agree with them and find out why. Because very rarely can you find someone who has a, you know, political idea who can accurately describe to you the opposition.
like all the way down to the nuts and bolts.
Right. Of it. And so, well, you know, these people think this, 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 and this, and be accurate about it. I mean, people have these hellacious ideas, you know, these are these people believe that the devil should run the world, you know, like, mm-hmm. No, they don't believe that.
Right.
They're regular people who, you know, there is a point at which the ideas diverge, but to really be able to understand what that point is and why those concepts are different, mm-hmm. most people don't take the time to okay. understand what the difference is, you know.
When you're with these people who are the Trump supporters, do you feel like an outsider, or do they feel like they're talking to somebody who's on the same page as them? Are you on the same page as them?
No.
Okay.
It's a very unique environment.
Okay.
It's a unique environment because I don't feel like an outsider, because I feel very confident in my position and okay. I feel very capable of explaining it to those who will listen. And I feel like the work environment, the professional environment requires that we remain civil, that we, you know, agree to disagree if that's the point we come to. So, you know, we kind of have the leashes on to some degree.
Okay.
So, you know, there's no fear. There's no like, you know, oh my God, I'm going to go too far, or they're going to go too far. I think everybody is responsible, and respectful.
Mm-hmm.
What I feel is that I see a lot of misinformation.
Okay.
And there is something to this effect of mob mentality. You know, you have a person who says the things you want to hear, and that sounds fantastic. Has nothing to do with whether or not it's accurate. Has nothing to do with whether or not it has any, you know, probative value. It has nothing to do with whether or not it's possible. They just said everything you wanted to hear. So yeah, let's get on the train.
Okay.
And I see that a lot.
Okay.
And you know, I think that's, you know, I kind of try to say, well, how would that work? You know, and they're kind of like, well, don't worry about it. Okay.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to worry about it.
Right. Somebody should.
But I do find that I tend to I do try to be, you know, reasonable and nurturing in the conversation and not, you know, like, you're wrong, shut up, that's stupid. You know, and I try to, you know, be political and you know, constructive. So it goes okay. I think that we in at least the last two conversations that I had in the last 2 weeks that I'm thinking of, I think I was able to impart some understanding.
Were you talking to other police officers? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
These conversations are generally with other
okay.
police officers.
Okay.
And I think I got to a point where I had another police officer who kind of said, oh, I never looked at it that way.
Hmm.
And so I was kind of like, all right, that's something. That's doing something.
Yeah. Yeah. And with the police officers, are you finding that this is... the ones who misunderstand, is it a challenge across the board when we're talking ethnicity, or is it specific to people who are not people of color?
I would say it has to do more with cultural awareness.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of Hispanic officers that don't have a lot of cultural awareness.
Mm.
And so even though they are Hispanic, it's not fair to say that they don't know what it means to be Hispanic, but they haven't embraced some of those cultural challenges.
Okay.
And so they kind of have a very whitewashed perspective.
Okay.
And when you kind of, you know, really kind of boil it down into, you know, what the issues are, what people, different people experience and how they feel, then you do get some, you know, I never really thought of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of like one front of my battle.
Okay. It's trying to help people who are not culturally aware.
Yeah.
But find themselves in those predicaments.
And it's a big thing. I mean, you know, there's so many different issues to talk about because I think education is a big part of it. You know, you essentially need no more than a GED to be a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could have a GED, be a culturally aware person, be a self-improving person, and be the best police officer that we've ever had. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, that's generally not the case. Mm-hmm. And so you're talking about people who are put into a very difficult cultural position, just being a police officer, which I think is a cultural position, given the communities of the city and the role that a police officer is expected to play. And they don't necessarily understand what that role is or what it should be. And I think that the more educated a person is, the more experience and exposure they have to that diversity and the reasons that people are the way that they are and the reasons that they do the things that they do.
Okay. From your professional perspective, what is the role of the police officer? What should it be?
That's deep. no, I mean, when I think of the role I would like the police to have, I think of a small town. Like you think of like an old movie, like from the 50s, and a small town where, you know, people say, well, you know, go get Sheriff Johnson, you know, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because he's the cop and, right. And let's go get him and he'll help. That obviously on a larger scale is, I think, the role of the police. I think that, you know, the police have a role to play outside of crime and punishment, outside of, you know, arresting and enforcing. I think that when an entity has that role for the 90% of the time that everybody's doing the right thing, mm-hmm. then they have legitimacy in the 10% of the time mm-hmm. when they're not. Mm-hmm. I think it makes a police officer a stakeholder in the community, mm-hmm. which I think that they're often not because they live very far away. And in an environment that looks very different from the environment that they work in. So I think, I mean, what I would like to see is I would like to see more people of color take ownership and responsibility for the policing of their own community. Because essentially we're still asking for something. And basically we're asking white people to treat us differently. And I think what the civil rights movement taught us is that it's not about asking them to do something different. It's about us doing something for ourselves and showing everyone that we can and that we deserve it and that we're capable. I think it's kind of like when you're a kid and you say, hey, my mom treats me like a kid. It's like, well, if you still live in your mom and you're in your mom's house and you're asking her to not treat you like a kid, then you're still a kid. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When you move out and you come back and you visit your mom and you say, mom, I'm going to take you out to lunch. That's when your mom stops treating you like a kid because you're not a kid because you're not in a position to be treated like a kid. So I think for us, we've created this somewhat contentious relationship with law enforcement, and the solution is for them to give us more, to treat us differently, to do more. But there is no them. There is no them when it comes to us policing our own community. There's us choosing to police our own community.
What would that look like? Like, let's look at our little enclave of Leimert Park as if it were a gated community. Mm-hmm. How would a community start to police itself?
Well, let me tell you, I work at the police academy. I see all of the new police recruits mm-hmm. that come through the academy. Mm-hmm. On average, there are 1 to 2 black people in each class of about 45.
Okay.
And that's not the city is making efforts. We went and talked to recruitment, and recruitment is actually, the lieutenant of recruitment is actually a black lieutenant mm-hmm. who says, you know, what can I do? Show me where do I get them? You know, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Black people in general in this city don't want to be police officers. And to me, it's like, okay, well, if you don't want to be a police officer, then, you know, who do you want to be your police officer? Because you're going to have a police, there's going to be a police officer, and you're saying you don't want to do it. Well, who do you want to have do it?
That's a really good question. Okay. I'm going to shift the conversation. I'm going to come back to the point you just made, but I want to just jump into some current event topics while they're fresh in my mind. And I'm not going to go like all the way back. I want to look at what just occurred. So again, from your professional perspective, if we look at the two deaths that happened, the two most recent shootings of Black men. So we're looking at Alton Sterling and Philando Castile. Based on what you saw, would you say that there was any type of police misconduct in either of those scenarios or both?
Okay. In the shooting in the car where the girlfriend is taking the video.
Philando.
Obviously, we don't see the shooting. I don't have any additional information. I don't know the circumstances leading up to or, you know, any of those kinds of things. It sounds to me, based on the demeanor of the officer that you can hear in the video and the demeanor of the person taking the video and the demeanor of the person who was shot, it seems to me like he made a horrible error that cost a person their life. And I don't think you can say that, you know, it was okay by any other, by any standard. Now that brings up another issue though, because the question is how does that kind of thing happen? And I think that kind of brings me to the other front that I was talking about in terms of a two-front war, is that I do understand the job of a police officer, and I know that it is much more complicated and difficult than I think a lot of people realize.
Okay.
And so that is not by any stretch of the imagination to suggest that it's okay. It's just I feel I have a little bit more insight into how that happens.
Okay.
Now, the other shooting in Louisiana, that to me is a difficult call to make. Because when you start talking about what actual tactical training is, what actual threats are, what potentials are in trying to take a person into custody when you know they're armed, it becomes a judgment call in a very volatile and an emergent situation that I don't think people generally can wrap their minds around. I mean, it's kind of like the movie Fight Club. He says, how much can you know about yourself? You've never been in a fight. How much can you know about yourself? You've never been in a position where there's a man with a gun trying to kill you and you're trying to stop him. It's a very, very difficult situation to try to analyze after the fact and say, well, this is exactly what they knew and what they should have done and what they should have known. It doesn't really work that way because we don't have that luxury. So there are some realities of being a police officer and the job that a police officer is expected to do that I don't think people are familiar with. I don't think that they have an understanding of what that looks like and what level of difficulty that situation can create. If we're talking about a more general, you know, blacks being shot by the police, do I think race is a huge issue? Absolutely. Absolutely, without a doubt. I think the problem that you run into when you go case by case and you look at an individual incident, it can be the flicker of a finger that makes the difference between what's justifiable or what's not. The reaching for a downward hand motion versus a sideways hand motion can be the difference between a justifiable shooting and a non-justifiable shooting. So I think the detail, we get lost in the details because it's a larger issue that we need to address. It's a larger issue that we need to focus on. But when you focus on one individual shooting, you can possibly back the wrong horse because the law says that police officers can do certain things. Policy says police officers can do certain things. And they're not necessarily in alignment with what people like or what people want to see. So it is a complicated issue. I think that the Louisiana shooting is, I would say, questionable. The other shooting is just, it seems like it's just wrong. It seems like he did something wrong. He made a mistake. He was scared. He did something. He may have asked the gentleman to do something and then was unprepared for him to do that. But again, I work at the police academy. I see recruits do that all the time. They back themselves into corners. They make mistakes. They do things that we teach, that we try to teach them not to do, because the end result can be extremely negative. As a department, we analyze the tactics leading up to an incident, the tactics during the incident, and then the aftermath. So the tactics leading up to an incident can be the officer's fault. Look, you put this person in a position where you had to shoot them, so that's your fault. But it doesn't necessarily mean that that person has nefarious intent. It means that they made poor tactical decisions.
In that situation, after I ask you this question, I'm going to pause and introduce you to everybody that just walked in the room. In that situation where a policeman has made a misjudgment on a tactical decision that has caused that person to now put somebody else in jeopardy, should that policeman be punished for that decision?
For LAPD, mm-hmm. that would be an administrative disapproval. It would mean that the department would say, look, you did this wrong. Now, does that translate to a violation of law? No, because the law doesn't say that you have to have this tactical stance, or that you have to do this before you take action. The law doesn't work that way. The law says, look, in this situation, you can do this, and in this situation, you can't. That's all the law says. And that's why I think people get so upset when there's no grand jury indictment. And the reality is that that's a totally different thing. That's a totally different standard. You know, whether or not the shooting is approved by the policy of the department, it's completely separate from whether or not there's any violation of law.
Okay. And pause right here, please. Because I think this is where you're going to educate us from your perspective on what you see, because that is where there's a definite impasse between the public and the police. Okay, so everybody, this is our friend David, who's been a police officer for 15 and a half years. This is Toria, Chris, you've met Irvin, you know my Chris, and this is Tasha. Hey! Hi. I'm so happy to see you here. The question I just asked David before you all walked in was based on the two recent shootings of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile. Did he see, from his professional perspective, any police misconduct? And he expounded upon his explanation there. I'll let you say it so I'm not paraphrasing for somebody who's sitting right here.
It seems to me that Minnesota? Yeah, the Minnesota shooting looked, and obviously we don't see the shooting, but we see the aftermath. And from what you can glean from that video, it looks like the officer's wrong. It looks to me like the officer's wrong. It looks like he panicked. He may have asked him to do something and was unprepared for the result. But it looks like a bad shooting to me. The Louisiana shooting to me looks questionable. It looks like, I don't know. It depends on what they knew. It depends on, you know, what he was doing, what that motion was. You know, I mean, there are circumstances where that could look very, very similar and be a justifiable shooting. But the specifics of that particular incident, impossible to really know what's in the minds of those officers in that moment, because that's really what the law is based on. The law is going to be based on what their belief was and was it reasonable for the situation. You know, if you get a call of a man with a gun and a guy's reaching towards his pocket, is it reasonable to think that that is a gun? Yes, and that's the way the law is going to look at it. So even if you're not making good choices, you're not making good decisions, the law says that that's going to be a justifiable shooting. And so I think that there's a disconnect between like what policy is and what procedure is and what tactics are, and then what the law says.
Because what that looks like to civilians who don't have all of that knowledge is that the police are protected by the law when they make decisions that are incorrect. So they might be punished at the job site, but that's about it. And now we're dealing with people who have lost a loved one and don't feel like they have an explanation as to why. So I think for all of us, the question becomes then, what next? Because to me, that's what creates the buildup and the tension between police and the people. The people don't feel like they're being served because they feel like the people who are supposed to protect them are out to harm them. For me, that's what I hear and read in general when these sort of circumstances happen. One thing David said before you all showed up was that one thing he feels we as people of color need to do, Black people specifically, is have a greater hand in policing our own communities. And part of that has to do with the amount of Black police officers that are actually in the force. I think you said you teach at the police academy. Out of a class of 45, you might have 1 to 2. Any women at all? Any Black women?
We call them unicorns.
Okay, because they're that rare.
Black women in the police academy, it's a unicorn.
Policing in the community, man, will get you in trouble.
What do you mean?
Because I can't go to no one else and try and enforce something that would allow us to not be able to get to let it go any further as far as trying to bring the law in. You know what I'm saying? If you're trying to police people in your community, you know what I'm saying? We're going to get looked at differently. You know what I mean? So, and might even be outcasted. So it's hard to say that for us to try and police our own community?
No, I mean become police officers.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
I mean actually
becoming something else.
Yeah. No, I got my bad. But yeah, I'm talking about actually becoming police officers.
That's difficult
to be in their own community.
That's interesting that you say that, because coming from education, none of the students that I've ever worked with are hollering, let's be a police officer, because they're not. And it's because of their perception of the police and what they know what's happened to their fathers, their uncles, their brothers, and their sisters. But I want to go back to the point, the Louisiana case. And my question is, but do you think police officers, perhaps whites more than blacks, approach black communities with a different mindset?
Absolutely.
And I think that's where the tension lies.
Yeah.
Because had Alton been a white guy, there's a piece of me that feels like there would have been this question of, is he mentally insane? Can we talk him down?
Mm-hmm.
But when we come into the black community, it's already like this sense of like trigger happy, or even how I approach you. It's this fear. And it happens in education too, right? My white teachers go into a black classroom and they got this little bit of fear for the little black kid that's like, no. And if Johnny said no, it's like, sit down, Johnny.
Oh, Johnny. Yeah.
Right. Oh, Johnny, sit down. But if Daquan said no, they're like, step back. Daquan's about to jump.
Right.
And I think that's the problem, that we see that so much.
I think that is 100% real, without a doubt. And I can say, even from my own perspective, I can remember going on radio calls with white officers, and I think there's a cultural difference. You know, I mean, you know, we are a culture. African Americans, we are a culture, and we have our own norms and practices. And I think that there are some things that basically white officers are uncomfortable with, and it's just outside their comfort zone. I can remember telling, you know, going to a radio call, somebody's upset, you know, expressing that they're upset to us, the officers, and you know, my partner saying, "Well, you know, you need to calm down. Why are you yelling at me?"
Right.
And I was kind of like, "Well, hold on, bro. Yeah. She's not yelling at you. Yeah. She's just yelling. She's mad.
Right.
Don't take that personally. Don't escalate the situation because you don't understand the person that you're talking to." And so, yeah, I mean, there's definitely a difference in the way that you know, the cultures interact. I think there is a problem with the way that law enforcement in general views black men. I think those things are 100% real.
Yeah. So how is that then addressed, like, in the academy, right? Is it very transparent? Like,
I mean, it is when I teach it. but again, I'm a black male, right. So, you know, I can be a little bit more real. You know, if their instructor was a white male, I don't know. You know, I don't know if they get the same, you know, level of candidness in that class. That's what I teach. I mean, I teach human relations in the police academy, and I teach, you know, about bias policing. I teach about, you know, victimology. I teach about all of those hot button items. You know, those are the things that I talk to the recruits about. So it's going to change. I mean, as being from education, you recognize, you know, you may have a teacher who's passionate and driven and, you know, provides kids with more than what's required. And then you may have another teacher who, you know, doesn't.
So how do we hold them accountable? Because I think that's where the tension, it's that, we know that, right? I asked just to see where you were coming from, but the Black community knows that, you know. So how is that addressed? Because that's where the tension is. Even if we say Louisiana was questionable, we say it's questionable too, because we wonder would they have handled that differently had he not been a 6'4", 300-some-pound Black man looking a white man in the face. White men don't like Black men looking them in the face, right? Mm-hmm. That's intimidating right off jump, you know? So how do we address that? Because that's where our tension comes from. That's what makes it questionable for us, right?
Okay, so that brings me to the idea that this, I'm not sure how much of this is a police issue or just a national issue. Because a lot of times when I have, and I was telling Kim earlier that, you know, I feel like I've kind of fight the war on two fronts, because at work, I'm explaining, you know, the diversity of the community. I'm explaining that to people that, you know, you have an intrinsic bias that you bring with you to the radio calls that you go to handle, that you carry with you when you're driving around in a police car. And those biases are felt by the communities that you serve. And, you know, I'm having that conversation on the one side. And then on the other side, I'm saying, well, there are some realities to police procedure and to law and to, you know, law enforcement that, you know, mean that there are certain things that have to be done. And these are the things that we can do when those things aren't done, or that these are the things that we have to do when those things aren't done. So there's kind of two sides. So in terms of what we can do, it's really hard, because you're talking about changing the way that white people look at Black people.
Yes.
And I don't know. I don't know how to change that. I have no idea. I mean, I can give young police officers in the police academy, you know, as much information and you know, diverse experience as I can, and try to expose them to the reality that, you know, the communities that they serve are no different from the communities that they come from. But it gets compounded when they go out to be police and they see the worst of humanity. They see the worst things that people do, and they form their perspective based on what they see, as we all do. And that's kind of a human nature kind of thing. I think that it's important for police officers to remember that what they're seeing is the worst of humanity. And it's, you know, regardless of race, you know, whether it was an all white community, they would be still seeing dead bodies and people who've done horrible things to each other. And, you know, all of these realities of being in law enforcement. But how do you get somebody to see the bigger picture, you know, when they live in Riverside and drive in to just be the police?
Because what you're really talking about to me, David, when I look at it, is that one, I mean, you didn't state this directly, but here we are making inferences again. Prejudice is taught. So you have people who come into the police force already with a preconceived notion about a group of people who they have no actual interaction with in the day to day. And then when they do have interaction, they're seeing the worst of the worst. And so all of that together just supports their already preconceived notion, and they take that with them, even if they interact with somebody who has nothing to do with the worst of the worst, but just happens to be a part of the same ethnic group.
Yes.
And as a police academy instructor, I guess, just like those of us who have been educators, our power to, I guess, deprogram what's coming from home and community is a greater challenge, because the amount of time we have to interact with said student is very limited.
Right.
I only have an hour with you. What I say to you is never going to be greater than what mommy and daddy says to you. But I want you to listen to me nonetheless, because it's for your greater, it's for your,
because I'm right, damn it.
Right. Pretty much, you know, because I'm right. But it's it's how it is when you're educating somebody about a situation that you're, that they're completely uninformed about. Your influence is limited in comparison to what's happening at home.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Black Is Break. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the subject. Hit us up. Let us know what you think. You can reach us on Facebook at Black Is Magazine, on Twitter at Black Is Online. You can hit us up via email at kc@blackisonline.com. Leave a message on the hotline, 323-455-4219. You can always check us out on our website, blackisonline.com. Thanks again.